Welcome to Gambling with an Edge. And now, here are Bob and Richard.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Gambling with an Edge. My name is Bob Dancer.
And I'm Richard Munchkin.
Our guest today is tax advisor Russell Fox, whose websites are taxabletalk.com and claytontax.com. Russell Fox, welcome back to Gambling with an Edge.
I'm glad to be back.
Before we start talking tax deals, we have a daily fantasy sports special at the Las Vegas Advisor that Richard wants to tell you about.
Yeah, I couldn't pass up talking about this because it's just too good a deal. The Las Vegas Advisor has made a deal with DraftKings. So if you sign up for DraftKings and deposit $5, there are seven states where...
Do you mean 500?
No, I mean $5. you get the Las Vegas Advisor and the coupon book for free. So that's an incredible deal. Oh, and you also get a copy of the book, Fantasy Sports Real Money by Bill Ordine. So, and if you already have that book, then there's other books you can get instead, which is also free. So for $5, if you're not already a member of Las Vegas Advisor, it's just a no-brainer to do that.
Can you be already a member of DraftKings? Do you have to be a new member of DraftKings too?
I think you have to be a new member.
Very good. Sounds good. All right. One of the main reasons we've invited Russell Fox back on today is end-of-year tax planning. This is always an issue, but we have a relatively new tax law in effect. Is there anything in that tax law that changes the way we do end-of-year stuff?
Not directly. However, indirectly, everyone who is a business owner should have met with or should immediately meet with their tax advisor. The new tax law has this new deduction for qualified business income, and it is definitely not a one-size-fits-all thing. So this is something that every business owner, and this is whether you have a Schedule C business, a Schedule E business, like rental property, or you are an owner of a partnership or an S-Corp, you should be talking to your tax advisor about this new law, how it impacts you, your business structure, and certain things that are needed or may be beneficial for you for the end of the year. The general things we've had in the past, like tax loss, harvesting, and things like that, nothing has changed with the new law.
Okay, and professional gamblers would be considered business owners.
Yes, professional gamblers file a Schedule C and definitely are business owners. Most of them are going to have a big benefit coming next year in the new deduction for qualified business income. And unless their income is fairly high, $157,500 taxable income if single, doubled if married, filing jointly, $315,000, they're going to get this benefit and probably don't need to change their structure. Might not, but probably don't.
I can always use extra money coming in. I'll try real hard not to make more than $157,500. Okay. Since the last time you were on the show 5 months ago, have there been any important laws or legal decisions that affect either gamblers and taxes or general citizens and taxes?
The only thing that happened is a New York case that came out this past week impacting DFS, where a New York judge ruled that in the state of New York, DFS, Daily Fantasy Sports, is unconstitutional under the state constitution. That decision undoubtedly is going to be appealed. So that's going to take 2 to 3 years to play out in the New York courts. So nothing really is going to change. On the other side of gambling, for everything else, absolutely nothing has come out in the last few months.
So the burning question on the Las Vegas Advisor's deposit $5 with DFS, if you're a New York resident, you should wait a few weeks for the appeal to go through? Or
no, they can go immediately. The appeal will be filed in the next 3-4 weeks. There's a time period that's automatic. The ruling is automatically stayed to give the state of New York time to appeal. So, and an appeal is certain.
Okay.
So you said 2 years, not 2 weeks.
Yes. It's going to take to 2020 or 2021 for a final decision.
Uh-huh. So pretty sure Anthony's coupon won't last that long.
Right.
Okay. Now, we are taping this show a few days before the 2018 election, to be aired just after the election. So nothing we say on this program is going to influence voters one way or the other. At the time of this program, the best guess is the Republicans will retain the Senate and the Democrats will take the House. Assuming for now that is true, at the risk of appealing very stupid, like it would be if you looked at the polls of 2016, do you see the next Congress passing any tax bills of consequence?
The next Congress, no. There is going to be a lame duck session between the November election in January, and there is a technical corrections bill that is probably going to pass that is probably going to be bipartisan in nature, fixing technical mistakes of the previous tax bill, the one that passed last December. But otherwise, a new Congress with a Democratic House and a Republican Senate, absolutely nothing of consequence in tax, and probably nothing of consequence anywhere, is going to pass.
All right. And have you seen this technical bill? Is that something for us to be concerned about?
No, it's not something to be concerned about. It really, for example, some provisions accidentally got written the wrong way. There are going to potentially be some provisions about other issues in tax, but nothing that I see in it that's going to impact gamblers.
All right. We asked our listeners for questions. Here are some of the better ones. If you hit a jackpot but are up for the year, can you say you don't have ID and come back after the first of the year and then claim the jackpot since you have up to 1 year to claim?
Yes, but it won't have the impact you want.
Uh-huh.
You can absolutely say, whoops, I forgot my ID. I'm going to come back next week. Problem is, it's still going to be income in the current year. There is a doctrine in tax, and it dates back over 100 years at this point, called constructive receipt. If something has been put aside for you and there are no strings attached, it's income in the current year. Good way of looking at it is like you get your business owner and you get a check in the mail on Saturday, December 31st. You can't deposit that check today. There's just banks are closed. So that's income the following year. If you get that check on Saturday, December 17th, you can deposit it in the current year. If you hold it to next year, it doesn't matter. It's still income in the current year. So just because something is, once you've won something, it's income in the current year unless there's a string attached. There's no string here. You just forgot something. That's not a valid string.
So what if I have income for this year, but I don't get the check until after January 1st. Does that mean it's not for this year? It's for next year?
Well, potentially yes, potentially no. In the situation we're talking about with a jackpot, where you could have gotten the income this year, had you brought your ID, it would have been this year's income. It's this year's income, even if you pick up the check next year. In a situation like where a check is mailed to you, you win a contest, and you're going to get it in the mail, and it doesn't come till the following year, it's income the following year. In that kind of situation, by the way, every tax professional will advise their client, save the envelope so you have proof and write on the envelope the date it was received. Because sometimes, you know, things might be mailed December 10th and it goes, instead of directly to Las Vegas, takes a scenic tour of the U.S. before it gets to you. So you want proof in this kind of situation, because you will probably get a 1099 or W-2G with the 2018 on it, but it's still going to be 2019 income to you. You didn't have a chance to put that in the bank in that situation.
So even if I get a W-2G that says 1099 that says 2018, but I didn't get the check until January 15th, it's 2019 income?
Yes, and this poses an obvious issue because the IRS won't know better. And so you run into some issues here.
But if I did declare it as 2018, the guy who gave me the 1099 and I both should be okay, right?
Most likely, yes. The dog won't bark. But if you declare it as 2019 and you have proof you didn't get it to 2019, you will win. It's part of the rule of constructive receipt. This rule's been around in tax for over 100 years, and it's pretty straightforward. You didn't have a chance to put that in the bank in 2018. So how could it be 2018 income?
Okay. Although I'm pretty sure the guy who wrote the initial question thinks you gave the wrong answer, but we're moving
he
on.
I was hoping you gave the wrong answer.
Another question. Can I use lottery tickets to write off winnings?
So the IRS, gambling is gambling is gambling. If you're a degenerate Keno player or a degenerate lottery player, those are gambling losses. And yes, they can write off other gambling winnings.
But only for professionals, right?
No, for amateurs. An amateur can still take an itemized deduction for his gambling losses up to the amount of winnings. Now, there's a question, I think, that's going to come up about how many amateur gamblers are going to itemize in the future, but they can. And gambling losses are still deductible up to the amount of winnings.
Oh, but the reason most don't is because the standard deduction has gone so much higher?
Yes, the standard deduction, the new tax law, there are two major changes that are going to impact everyone. Exemptions are gone. We used to get an exemption a little over $4,000 for every person on your return. So husband and wife and, say, two children, that's $16,000. That is gone. There are no exemptions anymore. However, the standard deduction was more or less doubled from $6,300 single to $12,000 and $12,600 to $24,000 if married filing jointly. You always have the choice of taking the standard deduction or itemizing. Your itemized deductions, though, are lessened this year. Miscellaneous itemized deductions are gone. So the itemized deductions that still exist are state and local taxes, but a maximum of $10,000. That's going to impact people in California and New York especially, where there are very high state income taxes. Charitable donations, mortgage interest, gambling losses are still allowed as an itemized deduction.
Okay, so it just won't make sense for most people to do it unless they have really substantial amounts of gambling.
Correct, and this is going to have a negative impact for amateur gamblers in the standpoint, if you consider an amateur gambler who used to itemize, myself as an example, this year I'll be itemizing. My mortgage interest, property tax, and charitable donations are definitely large enough I'm going to be itemizing this year. Assume next year, my mortgage is really dropping. I've reached the point, having owned my house here in Las Vegas enough years, my mortgage interest is not that high anymore. My property taxes aren't that high. We don't have state income tax here. I do get to deduct sales tax. That's not a lot. So my anticipation is I'm not itemizing in 2019. So it's going to have an impact on a lot of people.
Now, one way to read this question, can I use lottery tickets to write off winnings, was presumably the person, did not keep a contemporaneous log and was picking up lottery tickets and say, I have a handful of lottery tickets. Can I use them to help my income tax? Now, that would have been if you look at the question that way, the answer is better not do that. But
absolutely. You can't, if I have gambling winnings and want to take gambling losses, my own lottery losses, sure, they're deductible. But I can't deduct Richard's or Bob's. That's not allowed. It has to be, you can only deduct things you pay money for, not things others have paid money for.
But wasn't there some famous case of a horse player who was picking up all the losing tickets at the track and they found footprints on the back of some of them?
There are some other cases. For example, a gentleman claimed gambling losses on a date that he was at his daughter's wedding, and the court had some interesting words for him.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know. Actually, most of the family weddings, there would have been gambling going on.
on the Filipino side or the Chicago side?
Either one. You know, there'd be a card game at the reception. Yeah.
Uh-huh. All right.
I mean, what's a wedding without cards?
One question I've always had is the ability of win-loss statements to be used during tax season. This listener keeps a record of his gamblings in a traditional writing journal, per the many suggestions heard on the show. But what of those win-loss statements? Do they matter? Does the IRS accept them with a journal or in lieu of a journal?
The answer is it depends, which is the usual answer in tax. But one thing is true. With the IRS, the more is the merrier. The more documentation you have of your gambling losses, the more likely you are to survive an IRS audit. The problem is the disclaimers that appear on win-loss statements, and I picked out two from my files. I'd like to read them. The casino does not warrant that this statement provides a complete record of the account holder's gaming activity for the time period indicated. Rather, this statement is based upon the account holder's gaming activity while his or her player's card was being utilized. The second one reads, please be aware that the tracking system used to arrive at this amount is dependent upon your use of your casino card and also does not include slot tournament winnings, giveaway party winnings, race and sportsbook activity, poker activity, or keno activity. Therefore, this statement does not reflect an accurate accounting record. It merely provides an estimate that you can use to compare to your own records.
Uh-huh.
An intelligent IRS agent will read this.
Is that an oxymoron?
At times, yes. At times, no. There are a lot of people who work for the IRS who are very intelligent. And most of them get the law right more times than not when you're dealing with them. But I've had audits where win-loss statements by themselves were allowed. I've also had audits where they were not allowed. So your mileage will vary. I would have them, but I'd also have, and I'd strongly recommend you keep your own log.
All right. New question. I'd be interested in discussion related to how average mid-level players with a few W-2Gs will be impacted with the big increase of the standard deduction. Seems to me the average person now will take the standard and won't be able to itemize write-off losses against wins. Now, we have talked about this a bit. Do we have more to talk about on that?
Not really. Listener is absolutely correct. And there are, from my clientele, I know I have some clients who have dropped down in stakes for their gambling so that they will get fewer W-2Gs. So they will be less impacted by this. Instead of gambling, perhaps, or being a slot advantage player at the $1 or $5 level where W-2Gs are given, they're dropping to the 25-cent level where there are going to be far fewer W-2Gs. So I think the listener is absolutely right. This is going to have a negative impact on the amateur gambler. The professional, it has no impact. And in fact, professional gamblers are generally going to be benefited by the tax law in many ways.
Very good. New question.
Actually, wait. Uh-huh. Let me just follow up on that. So I filed as a professional gambler for many years, but I sort of officially retired, as our listeners know.
Again?
But let's say that I play a little bit. Can I still file as a professional, even though I didn't play all that much?
The U.S. Supreme Court ruled in a case called Gretzinger that a professional gambler is somebody who gambles for their livelihood to pay their bills. Has to be looked at a facts and circumstances test for each person. So could you be retired from a day job and still be a professional gambler? Yes. You also might not be.
No, but I mean, I'm retired as a professional gambler. That was my day job.
You can unretire. People go back to work all the time.
Right, but let's say I only made, three trips the entire year.
Probably not.
Okay.
It's based on facts and circumstances. If you're not supporting yourself from gambling or trying to support yourself from gambling, you're not a professional gambler. It's the trying. You can be a losing gambler. But if you're trying to support yourself from gambling, you will likely be considered under the tax law professional.
All right. Say a player has $100,000 of gambling wins and $100,000 of gambling losses, all documented but not previously known to the government. If the choice was between putting both numbers down, canceling each other out, and leaving both numbers off, which one is more likely to trigger an audit?
Well, they both can. And the problem is, first of all, if you have $100,000 of gambling winnings and you have W-2Gs, if you don't put them down, you're going to have a problem. The IRS matches this. And if you have W-2Gs, they need to be on your tax return, period. So if you leave off, or let's say $70,000 of W-2Gs, the IRS is going to notice that. They're going to expect it in one of two places, either in other income, or they're going to expect it on a Schedule C if you're a professional gambler. If you don't have it, it's almost certain you will get a notice from the IRS.
But
this sounds more like somebody who's a poker player or a blackjack table games player.
Then we get into the issue, though. I can never advise somebody to not comply with the law. The law says you must put down your gambling winnings separate from your gambling losses. The IRS will always accept winnings they don't know about for obvious reasons. However, I have represented clients in audits where they've been asked to justify their gambling losses. Now, my clients, all who have been so audited, had logs, and you know the audits weren't a big issue. They won no change audits, and I think it's now five cases I've had in 19 years on this issue. The IRS does audit this area, so it is something that can be audited. Putting down gambling winnings that you don't know about, that gambling winnings that the IRS doesn't know about isn't going to be an issue. The other issue, though, goes with leaving it off. You can get in trouble. There are numerous court cases where people, and especially in the bad states for gamblers, have left this off because it netted to zero, and from an IRS standpoint, nothing changed. Problem is, state tax agencies audit too. The bad states, by the way, are Connecticut, Illinois, Indiana, Kansas, Massachusetts, but with a big caveat. Massachusetts now has one casino, I believe, open in Springfield, and Massachusetts amended their law, and Massachusetts gambling losses are allowed from a Massachusetts licensed casino against Massachusetts gambling winnings.
Only from their casino?
Only from any casino in Massachusetts.
They do have one in Plain Ridge Park, which is in the Foxborough area.
Okay, so there's two now. So they're up to two.
Wow.
Okay. I know that the one in Boston or near Boston is going to open next year. So they'll be up to three.
Well, the Plain Ridge Park is definitely near Boston.
Okay.
So it's been open for a few years. It's a Penn National property.
Okay. There's another one in I think
Everett or something.
Yeah, Everett, but that's going to open soon. But that's good news for Massachusetts gamblers. Continuing, the other bad states are Michigan, Ohio, North Carolina, Rhode Island, West Virginia, Wisconsin, and also Minnesota if you're an amateur gambler. Okay, they have an alternative minimum tax that very negatively impacts gambling.
But the other thing is, if the guy had $100,000 in wins and 100 losses, yes, they're going to zero out, but isn't that going to affect you in some other way if you're an amateur gambler? That your alternative minimum tax or your...
AMT is not impacted by gambling. That's a misnomer. Okay. You are allowed gambling losses under the AMT. However, there are other negative impacts of gambling winnings. The healthcare law, that is based on adjusted gross income. So let us assume you gamble and you have 100,000 of wins and 100,000 of losses and 7,000 of other income. You're no longer eligible for a tax credit under the healthcare law because you have 107,000 of income, even though you really have 7,000. It impacts student loan repayment. Student loan repayment is based on your adjusted gross income, which is gambling wins but not losses. I have several clients, married couples, who one of the spouses has student loans they're paying off and they file separately so that this issue does not impact them. So there's like Roth IRA. the ability to contribute to a Roth IRA is based on your modified adjusted gross income. Again, gambling wins are used, not losses. There's a lot of area in tax law where gambling winnings has a very negative impact. I don't expect this to ever change because Congress likes taxing sin.
Well, they like taxing your sin, not, I mean, taxing the other guy's sin is a good way to get money. Just not taxing your own. All right, new question. Let's say a United States citizen is gambling in London and wins £3,000. Apparently, the limit in the United Kingdom is £1,400 before tax information is collected by the casino and sent to the governing tax agency. So, assume this happens. Is this information collected by the United Kingdom Tax Authority transmitted to the United States IRS?
So, probably. The U.S. and U.K. do exchange tax information. Under the law that passed several years ago called FATCA, the Foreign Account Tax Compliance Act, the U.S. and various countries exchange tax information. So you have to assume it is. I can't state with certainty that gambling income is exchanged, but it certainly could be.
There's something weird about that because I didn't think gambling winnings were taxable in the United Kingdom. But I think that may have to do with cash transactions or things like that. I don't know.
Gambling is not taxable in the UK. That's absolutely correct. But it's still possible. Laws are weird. And so it wouldn't shock me that the law says we have to collect the tax information, but you still don't have to pay tax on it. There's plenty of laws in the US like that where information is collected. And it reminds me of an old episode of Get Smart. Make five copies and burn them all.
When we talk about gaining £3,000 and FATCA, somehow it reminds me my diet isn't going so well. The concept of a gambling session seems fuzzy. So there's several questions this listener asked on this. Does changing a machine or denomination affect sessions? Does it matter whether you cash out the ticket into cash or just insert the ticket into another machine? Does it matter if you take a two-hour dinner break before resuming gambling?
Well, this allows me to bring up one of my favorite cases of recent past, the 2013 case decided by the U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia, which is the second highest court, by a name that may be familiar to our listeners, Brett Kavanaugh.
Does he drink beer?
I suspect he
does.
He
likes beer.
Yes, and I'm going to start with the beginning of the decision because it's wonderfully written. And you can find this, by the way, on the D.C. Court of Appeals website, anyone who really wants to read this. After a night of gambling, it's no fun to walk out of the casino a loser. But it's even worse when the IRS, on your way out, tries to tax you on each individual bet that you happen to win over the course of your losing night. Enter Sang Park, a South Korean businessman who gambled away thousands of dollars at slot machines on casino outings during his trips to the United States, only then to have the IRS seek more in taxes. Okay, this case has to do with a non-resident aliens gambler. And the law, the way the IRS interpreted it at the time, said every time you pull a slot machine, you're taxed. So you pull a slot machine and win $1,000, pull a slot machine right after and lose $1,000, tough. You're taxed on $1,000, even if these two events happened right after each other, you netted nothing. The Court of Appeals said no. The session accounting is absolutely allowed for Americans, and that's referenced within this decision. So this means, and this is a decision that is absolutely precedential, session accounting is allowed. So basically, you can go from machine to machine in one session and net everything. You can go from table to table. You don't like the dealer at blackjack table 2 and you move to table 3, same session. But a session has a discrete beginning and end. That's the common definition of one. So you have to look at when does a session end? Let's say you come to Las Vegas, you're from out of town, and you play in the casino today, Saturday, tomorrow, Sunday, and then the next day, Monday, for 3 hours at a time. Is that one giant session? Probably not. It's probably three sessions of 3 hours. You come to Las Vegas this week and you come in 3 months. Is that the same session, those two trips together? No, that has no chance of passing the smell test. But it's still possible that first trip, each of those three times you're in the casino could be looked at by a session. It would depend on the judge. It's going to be based on facts and circumstances. But the more conservative you are, the more likely it is to pass muster. So getting back to the questions here, does it matter if you cash out the ticket into cash or insert the ticket into another machine? No, doesn't matter. As long as it's part of the same playing. The two-hour dinner break, if you are, for example, playing poker and you leave your chips on the table, probably the same session. You go with your wife to a different casino, have dinner, come back, probably different sessions.
I sometimes play graveyard, which is defined differently, but basically after midnight. There are casinos have casino days that start at 2 in the morning, 3 in the morning, 6 in the morning, etc. They vary. So if I'm playing at a casino which has a casino day starting at 3 a.m., if I hit a W2G at 2 a.m., it basically will have yesterday's date on it. And then if I hit another one at 3:30, it'll have today's date on it. On my personal records, even though the W2Gs have different date, they're combined into one session, and I do that consistently. Is there a problem with that?
No. If you keep your own records, the court would look at it and say 2 a.m. and 3:30 a.m. of the same calendar day is part of the same calendar day. Regardless of how the casino internally keeps their accounting, you're allowed to use them in the same day. That's just common sense.
All right. We have lots more questions for Russell Fox. We are going to take a commercial break. So hang around. We'll be back. The South Point has more than 10,000 games returning more than 99%. This is more than anyone else has. In November, there is effectively double points all month long in terms of Walmart gift cards. Earn and redeem $25 worth of points, namely $8,334, and exchange them for a $50 gift card. Limit 10 cards per person. So double points there would mean 0.6%. Some of you are used to playing at casinos where double points means 0.2%. This is three times that good. On Thanksgiving Day, there's a $32,000 hot seat promotion. Every 3 minutes between 8 a.m. and midnight, one lucky player with card inserted will receive $100 in free play. Every Monday is Seniors Day, half price meals and bingo if you use your points, and there's a free senior slot tournament, Auto Slash. Richard, it's time for you to participate in the commercials. What? Tell us about Auto Slash.
Okay, there's six things you need to know about Auto Slash. Number one, it's free. Number two, Bob and I have been using it for years. We were recommending it on the show before they ever became a sponsor. Number three, they allow you to put in any of the possible affiliations you have, like your airline frequent flyer or Visa, MasterCard, Costco membership, so they can find coupons for any discounts that might exist out there. When you put in your trip, they will give you the option to pay right now. In my own case, when I did this, the discount was 17%. That reservation is still allowed to be canceled up to 48 hours before it's due. And the best thing about AutoSlash is the tracker. So if you reserve a car either through searching at autoslash.com or any other car rental website, you go and put that reservation in their tracker, and any time between the time you make the reservation and the time you are ready to pick up the car, if they find a cheaper price, you get an email that says, hey, we found it cheaper, and you make a new reservation. So in my own case, I have a reservation for next week. I put it in about a month ago when they became a sponsor. And it started out, it's just a two-day rental. It started out at $94, and it's gone down several times. And I got an email just this morning that it's at $65. And it's gone from an economy compact car to a SUV. So autoslash.com, check it out.
Sounds good. Maybe you should go to a Ferrari and see if you can get a better discount. Good. All right. At videopoker.com, it's the best place to play lots of games. If you sign up for the gold membership, $8.95 a month or $79.95 a year, this allows you to get correction on most of the games. They have a 1 month of free gold membership for our listeners, videopoker.com/GWAE, if you'd like to check it out. And it's for new members only. It expires the end of the year. The game of the week is Stack the Deck. This is 7 coins per line game. We're on dealt hands of trips, quads, full houses, and four to the royal. You receive from 3 to 5 cards of the exact card to make up your hand. That is, if you're dealt 3, 3, 3, 6, 6, and instead of having one extra 3 to make the quads, if you draw to it, you now have 6 threes out of 52 cards, giving you plenty of chances for quads, quints, and quads with a quick kicker. They have extra pay schedule categories of a baby royal, king to 9 in the same suit, and 5 of a kind. Since the game is fixed as a 7-coin game, sometimes they have to change the pay schedule to make the game within acceptable bounds, meaning loose enough to be interesting to the players and tight enough to be interesting to the casino. So a 9-6-4 double-double game, which starts out as basically 99% even, in the Stack the Deck version, it's 10-7-5, which requires considerable number of strategic changes to play appropriately. All right, we've been talking to Russell Fox, and we still are as soon as I get back to that page. Aha, here we are. A listener in Texas, which now has legal poker houses where you can become a member, pay an hourly fee to play, and they gamble amongst the other members. No win-loss records are kept at all by the house, so presumably it's on the honor system whether you report this or not. Is this any different than any other gambling wins and losses?
All income is taxable unless Congress has exempted it. Congress has not exempted poker winnings in Texas. They must be reported. This is no different from any other gambling winnings or losses.
Again, our listeners think you're giving the bad answer.
You know, they know the answer to this question before they ask. I mean.
I was asked a question by a former client that basically said, Russ, I would like to commit tax evasion. How can I do that? I declined to answer that question.
Uh-huh, you say, I have a friend I can recommend you to, but I'm not the right guy for you. Consider the case of a professional gambler, John, and a non-gambler, Sally. They enter into a written agreement where John provides all the money for Sally to play slot or video poker progressives. On some of these, Sally wins. Casinos reward Sally for her play and give her incentives to play more. Cashback, tournaments, all kinds of good stuff. The basic deal is that Sally gets a free roll and receives 25% of the win calculated annually. In a given year, say, Sally has received $20,000 in W2Gs, the team netted $4,000, and Sally ended up receiving $1,000 net. Before any of these results happened, the two had this written contract defining the relationship. So how should that contract be constructed? How should the professional gambler record this tax-wise? How should the amateur record this tax-wise?
I am not an attorney, so I cannot talk about how a contract should be constructed. So that's something they should go to an attorney to talk about and discuss. As far as the tax implications, I think this is a very interesting scenario in that Sally is basically working as a professional gambler, whether she is one or not. This isn't gambling for her own benefit other than the 25% she's being paid for her time. If Sally structures this correctly, this particular activity could be considered a professional activity as a business and put on a Schedule C, regardless of whether Sally otherwise is a professional or amateur gambler. Because basically, Sally's being paid a salary. Her salary is just determined by her net winnings. She's basically being paid to pull a slot machine. That happens to be a progressive that's paying a lot of money. She's not really gambling with her own money here. She's gambling with somebody else's money. So structurally, she's basically being paid to just pull a lever, and if she makes money, she gets to keep it, 25%. All the money goes back to the original person, John, and then John pays a stipend for her to basically pull the machine of 25% of the income. So I'm thinking this is a Schedule C activity for Sally, regardless of her normal gambling status.
Even though this is not a... She has no realistic expectation of making a living on this at $1,000 a year.
No, but the activity is such. It's a question of the activity itself. She's doing this basically to, you know, for a reason, because she's being paid money to do this. Most of the contracts I've seen like this offer, like, we'll pay you $300 or 25% of winnings, whichever is greater. You pull the machine. And consider the fact that a 1099 is going to have to be issued from John to Sally. What's that 1099 for? Is it for gambling winnings or is it for non-employee compensation? I think a good case could be made. It's really non-employee compensation. She's being paid to pull the lever, not for the gambling itself. The gambling goes back to John. So I
had a friend who ran a team exactly like this. Now, obviously, a lot has changed because this was going back 30 years. But there used to be an IRS form that the casinos would have where when she hit the jackpot, she would say, this money is not going to me, it's going to John. And they would fill out this form that said, the money is going to John, and therefore he had the tax implications. And then he would 1099 all the people who worked for him in this capacity.
That form still exists. It's form 5754. You can get it on the IRS website. Problem is today, not every casino will accept it. And you run into rules about gambling for somebody else that exist on the casino level.
Yeah, and now they'll probably just bar you from play because they know you're a professional of some sort.
Correct. So you run into, it's better for Sally to issue a 1099 to John for probably the entire gambling winnings as gambling activity. John to issue a 1099 back to Sally for $1,000, that's Sally's net income is non-employee compensation. Now, without talking to both individuals, and obviously this is a hypothetical case about the scenario, that's my first impression of how I would handle it.
Good. But you would recommend consulting with an attorney to set this up right? Or could bright people likely figure it out themselves?
That's a question I cannot answer because I'd be construed as giving legal advice. So I want to avoid that question.
Uh-huh. Some accountants are slippery.
Sounds pretty complicated to me, actually. I mean,
okay.
For $1,000, I probably would not go to an attorney, but if you were doing this in a big way, I absolutely would.
Yeah, it's just like, you know, an attorney is going to charge you $300-$400 an hour. It's well worth it to do a contract right than to have an oops moment.
Yeah, especially if it's 200,000 in W-2Gs and... All right. Another question. Assume a player has been kicked out of numerous casinos who will not likely cooperate at documenting tax information. But also, the player's ID was often obtained by backrooming procedures against the player's will. Assuming the player wishes to pay the appropriate amount of taxes to avoid further problems, should the way he documents tax information be any different than players who do not have such an hostile relationship with the casino?
No, it shouldn't be any different. And in fact, let's assume you're barred from some casino. And the casino says, we are going to close your player's account. You cannot get anything online. Here's your last W-2G. We're not going to issue a win-loss statement. We're not going to help you in any way. I would still recommend that the player send at the end of the year a certified letter to the casino saying, I would like my win-loss statement. I am putting together my tax documentation for the IRS. I need this. Most likely, he'll get it back because casinos are regulated bodies in almost every state. You know, some are Indian casinos, Native American casinos, different kind of regulatory activity, but most are regulated by the state. The state wants cooperation with the patrons, whether you bar them or not. The IRS does not look kindly upon businesses not sending tax documentation to individuals. So most likely in such a situation, that individual would get back in the mail his win-loss statement.
Yeah, I've never heard of that one. I've never heard of them refusing to send a win-loss statement before. I've heard of them rescinding comps and things, but the tax form, it's usually a totally different department, and you know, their clerks sitting in offices sending out forms.
And I remember years ago I had an audit, and we were trying to get from a bank, told not a gambler at all, but we were trying to get from the bank bank statements, and the bank had closed my client's account and refused to cooperate. So we called the IRS agent handling the audit and saying, look, please issue a summons to the bank. The bank is not willing to cooperate with us. They've got to cooperate with you with a summons. You know, we were up front with the auditor, and the auditor called the bank in front of me, and the bank refused to send it to the auditor.
Wow.
The auditor's face went red.
How do you say cojones in tax talk?
No, that's not cojones. That's stupidity.
Yes, it was stupidity. I don't know why the bank felt that way, but eventually the bank did send the information to the IRS. But the IRS understood completely why we were having problems with the bank. And that audit went a lot better because the auditor didn't think we were telling the truth. And it turned out she got plenty of evidence that we were really telling the truth.
Huh, what would cause that? Just dating the banker's daughter without... All right. We have time for a few more questions. You have this website, taxabletalk.com. Less than 2 months ago, you wrote a piece called Can a Professional Gambler Take a Foreign Earned Income Exclusion? What was that all about?
Well, one of the things that's happened because of poker legality in the U.S., online poker, a lot of poker players have moved outside the U.S. I have clients living in Europe, Central America, and Asia who play poker professionally. They play online poker. They want to play on the world-facing sites, not the legal sites in Nevada and New Jersey. And for them, they're living abroad, and the question came up, can they take the foreign earned income exclusion? Foreign earned income exclusion is a part of the tax code that says that if you are living abroad, living outside the United States, have earned income, that's a caveat, it's foreign earned income exclusion, you're allowed to exclude the first plus or minus $100,000 from U.S. income tax. Earned income is defined as wages and self-employment income, Schedule C, that a professional gambler files. And so, assuming that a professional gambler qualifies, there are some rules about this, you have to either be a bona fide resident of a foreign country. Let's say you have dual U.S.-Canadian citizenship, and you're living in Canada. Bona fide residence certainly includes being a citizen of that country. Or you're a permanent resident of a country. Some people have applied for and gotten residencies in, say, the Netherlands or Thailand. That's, again, bona fide residence. You're a bona fide residence for a full calendar year, or you're outside the U.S. for 330 days out of a 365 consecutive day period, you're eligible for the exclusion.
Oh, wait. So if you're a foreign resident, you can be here more than 35 days?
Yes. If you are let's say you are a Canadian citizen. You have dual U.S.-Canadian citizenship. You were Canadian parents, but you were born in the U.S. Remember, U.S. has birthright citizenship. If you're born in the U.S., you're a U.S. citizen.
So there's somebody who wants to change that. I think I might have read somewhere.
But as of today, that's the law. And so if you're a Canadian citizen, but you spend 3 months in the U.S. as a U.S. citizen, your foreign income, income earned in Canada, not income earned in the U.S., is eligible for exclusion under the foreign earned income exclusion.
Okay. Yeah, I have a brother who lives in Singapore. And I remember before he became a resident, he couldn't be here more than it's gone up to 35. I think it used to be less days that you could be in the United States. But now he has a residency there, so I guess he could come back more. But
but you also said any 365-day period, which could be June 1st to May 30th. It didn't have to be a calendar. Is that right?
That is correct. If you take a 365 consecutive day period that falls over 2 years, the exclusion is prorated. You don't get the full exclusion. You get it based on the number of days in the current year, the tax year that you're filing for, that are part of the exclusion period. So if you
you could do it two consecutive years.
And you can use different periods for 2 years. So let's say you moved to France on July 1st. And so for the current year, you basically get half a year exclusion. For next year, let's say you're in France the entire year of 2019, you'd get the full exclusion.
Okay. And living abroad is not the same as living with the – never mind. Never mind. I apologize for saying that. I'm going to get letters. I apologize. Okay. One last question for Russell Fox. He wrote an article about 3 months ago, said, should I violate federal law or state law when you're making a tax decision?
Well, that article is about our wonderful legislature in Nevada that passed a law saying that enrolled agents, which is my license, it's a federal license and dates back to President Chester A. Arthur, I'm sure is on the tip of everyone's tongue.
Wasn't he right after Grant?
I believe so. That should tell you how old it was. And there was no income tax, by the way, at that time, just to know. But somehow that profession called enrolled agents became what my profession is today. And that's another story for another day. Nevada legislature passed a law saying that enrolled agents are only document preparers and we can't negotiate with things and people like tax agencies. Of course, that's what we do. We also would fall under a lot of other rules that basically I would have a choice. If I obeyed the law that the Nevada legislature passed, I'd be violating what is called Circular 230, which is a federal regulation, which has the force of law. Or I could obey Circular 230 and violate Nevada law. So the Nevada Society of Enrolled Agents, which I'm a member of, sued the state of Nevada, and a temporary restraining order went into place last year towards the end of 2017. A trial was held in Carson City, and the law was basically ruled unconstitutional. The state has not appealed it because the judge's ruling was pretty clear, pretty obvious, and so that law is dead.
So Chester Arthur doesn't have to roll over in his grave?
No.
All right. I actually didn't find that question really useful to our audience, but I thought it was really kind of interesting, which is why I asked him. It's a pleasure to have you on here. Is your email address staying the same? R.C. Fox.
R.C. Fox at claytontax.com.
And it'll be in the show notes as well as the website.
Very good. Thank you, Russell Fox. Thank you, Richard. Go out and hit lots of royal flushes, everybody. Good day.